Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link, live from Bonn, Germany. My name is Abubakar Jallo. Coming up, Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari is asking for help from the United Nations to secure the release of the schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram in the town of Chibok. So how is this going to play out?
It is extremely difficult for the Nigerian government or even for the United Nations itself to put itself in a position to actually speak to the right people in terms of securing the safe release of the Chibok hostages.
And the treatment of African migrants in the Middle East, especially in war-torn Yemen, is now considered a serious issue, and experts want to find a solution to it as they meet in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
We've had over 85,000 individuals coming from the Horn of Africa and arriving in Yemen. Last year, in 2015, we had a similar number of individuals that arrived in the Horn of Africa from Yemen.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link on Friday, September the 23rd.
Top story.
Now, in our human rights segment today, we will bring you a report on Burundi, where UN investigators said that the government was behind systematic human rights violations, including executions and torture. That's coming up in the second half of the program. But first, Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has asked the United Nations to help in negotiations with the Islamist militant group Boko Haram to secure the release of over 200 schoolgirls kidnapped in the town of Chibok over 2 years ago. Speaking on the sidelines of the annual UN General Assembly meeting in New York, President Buhari said that a split within the ranks of Boko Haram, which is affiliated to the self-styled Islamic State or IS, made it difficult to hold talks. So, why now is Nigeria turning to the international community for help? A question my colleague Eunice Wanjiru put to Ryan Cummins, a Nigeria security expert and director of the independent risk analysis group Signal Risk in South Africa.
The primary issue is that obviously the insurgent group known as Boko Haram or the Islamic State West Africa province, first and foremost, is extremely antagonistic towards the regime of Muhammadu Buhari, obviously sees it as its enemy, and due to the stance, may be unwilling to engage the Nigerian government in any of negotiations, specifically amid the ongoing counterinsurgency operations that the Nigerian government and its, you know, regional partners are launching against the Islamist extremist group. There might be the perception, for example, that a intermediary, you know, in the negotiations, you know, someone who doesn't necessarily have a vested interest in terms of the trajectory of the conflict itself, might be a more feasible arbitrator of the negotiations surrounding the release of the Chibok girls.
And how much can the UN help in the negotiations with Boko Haram?
Well, it's very difficult because one of the major issues with the Boko Haram group is the lack of accessibility to them. We also don't have a very strong ideal or conception of what the group's leadership entails, what its leadership structures are, and indeed who is currently heading the movement. As we know, there's been a factional split within Boko Haram, you know, with one faction still loyal to Abu Shekau, who has led the group since the death of its founder, Muhammad Yusuf, in 2009. But there's also a group who is claimed to be led by Abu Musab al-Barnawi, who is reportedly the Islamic State-appointed emir. So when you don't have a very clear leadership structure and you don't have really clear individuals that you can negotiate with, it is extremely difficult for the Nigerian government or even for the United Nations itself to put itself in a position to actually speak to the right people in terms of securing the safe release of the Chibok hostages.
So can we see this as a failure on Nigeria's part to negotiate with Boko Haram now that they're asking UN for help?
The tricky issue is, firstly, that the power dynamic in the insurgency is very different under President Buhari's regime than it was, you know, under President Goodluck Jonathan's regime. When the Chibok girls, for example, was initially kidnapped, Boko Haram had effectively begun establishing what is known as a Daula, or an Islamic-led state within northeastern Nigeria. And the group an extremely strong bargaining position into any negotiations with Boko Haram, then by Goodluck Jonathan's government, he would effectively be doing so on the back foot and would have obviously have to concede to several demands that Boko Haram had at the stage, which could have increased the group's ability to assimilate more territory in northeastern Nigeria, and then also just to continue its kidnapping of civilians, you know, if there was a successful negotiation, because I think that is always the biggest concern, that, you know, if there is a negotiated settlement to the abductions, as there had been previously, that this would operational tactic that Boko Haram will then continue to use as it continues its armed campaign again. Nigerian government at this stage is obviously would probably be more inclined to get the group at the bargaining table because it holds a stronger position of power. But the main issue is that it all depends on the willingness of Boko Haram to negotiate either with the Nigerian government or with any other body that is deemed to be a third party that's willing to secure the release of the gold.
Ryan Comment, Director of Independent Risk Analysis Group Signal Risk in South Africa. So how did members of the Chibok community react to the news? Tsambido Hosia Abana is chairman of the Chibok Association in Abuja, and this is what he told us.
So I have not got the reaction of our people in the village yet.
I haven't got any reactions from our people in the village yet, but I read the statement myself, and we support anyone who will come in as an intermediary to support our efforts to rescue the girls. We have trust in the United Nations that they will do a credible job, and this time we will see that the girls will be freed.
Really a move to free this girl.
That was Tsambido Hosia Abana, chairman of Chibok Association in Abuja, talking about the kidnapping of the over 200 schoolgirls in 2014, which brought a global attention to the Nigerian conflict. The government then, under President Goodluck Jonathan, came under significant pressure to rescue the girls. When President Buhari took power in May 2015, he promised to make the rescue of the girls his top priority.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
To the Horn of Africa now, where migration and labor officials from countries in the region have agreed to find strategic solutions to the migrant crisis. They are currently meeting in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, to discuss the insecurity facing many migrants while crisscrossing the region. Some are on the move, often to escape the conflict in their home countries. Others, well, for economic reasons. But many are often maltreated, whether in the region or in the Middle East, and especially in neighboring war-torn Yemen. Coletta Wanjohi reports.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, reports that in the Horn of Africa, citizens mainly from Ethiopia go through Somalia and Djibouti and across the Gulf of Aden to Yemen and the Gulf states. Migration experts meeting in Addis Ababa have noted that conflicts in South Sudan and Yemen, as well as the decision by Kenya to close the Dadaab refugee camps that is home to more than 300,000 Somalis, are responsible for the migration for civilians in search for safer places. Clementine Salami, the UNHCR representative in Ethiopia, further explains.
The onward movement of Eritrean and Somali refugees, notably from Sudan and Ethiopia, create concerns, particularly given the dangerous journeys refugees take, including unaccompanied or separated children.
Craig Murphy, the regional program coordinator for International Organization for Migration, says that illegal migration in the region has increased.
We've had this year so far, in the first 8 months of 2016, we've had over 85,000 individuals coming from the Horn of Africa and arriving in Yemen. Last year, in 2015, we had a similar number of individuals that arrived in the Horn of Africa from Yemen. So it is really at a crossroads, and we have bidirectional flows of people.
Since 2015, after the conflict broke out in Yemen, the International Organization for Migration says there has been a greater influx into the Horn of Africa. Craig Murphy from IOM explains the challenge of migration the region is facing.
The challenge is that there are large numbers of people that are on the move. Each of the individuals that are within these mixed flows has a different profile. So it is a challenge for the individuals that are working on the government actors, as well as international organizations like IOM, to really identify those needs to work to provide a relevant and strategic solution to them.
Yemeni authorities continue to detain African illegal migrants, fearing that they could have been new recruits for militant groups in the country.
Coletta Wanjohi reporting, and you're listening to DW's Africa Link, coming to you live from Bonn, Germany.
Human rights.
For our human rights segment, we go to Burundi, where UN investigators had said on Tuesday that the Burundian government was behind a systematic human rights violation, including execution and torture. They also warned of the looming risk of violence. Genocide, I'm afraid. Sorry. Now, the Burundian government has rejected that report, saying it was politically motivated. From Bujumbura, Apollinaire Nyirora report.
While the Burundian government acknowledges that there have been violations of human rights since April last year, Burundi's Human Rights Minister Martin Vyabandi has denied a UN report that talks of a possible genocide and systematic killings taking place in the country.
The government doesn't deny that there is violation of human rights, as it is in other countries. We have some challenges we have to address as a government, as a society. And everybody are invited to be involved in this process of protection and promotion of human rights in Burundi.
However, an opposition leader, Thacien Sibomana, told the DW that the content of the report clearly depicts what is happening in Burundi.
The risk of a genocide should not be discarded because they are claiming a possible killing of the president that should be revenged through massacres. If we consider that security agents often sequestrate neighborhoods with a Tutsi majority, when we realize that three-quarters of inmates are Tutsis and that non-commissioned army officers who are harassed are Tutsis, the crisis that was of a political nature unfortunately turns into an ethnic crisis as managed by current leaders.
On the issue of cancelling Burundi's participation at the UN Human Rights Council, Minister Nivyabandi said this shows that the three UN independent experts who authored the report were politically driven during their assignment.
They proposed that Burundi must be removed from the Human Rights Council. Those are elements which show us that it is a political guided report. The report targets a political process. But what is very important is to tell you that we'll be in Geneva by 27 September and they will give the true version of facts which occurred in Burundi during this period covered by the report.
According to the report, executions have been committed on a large scale by security forces, often supported by the ruling party's youth wing known as Imbonerakure, adding that the majority of the victims were opposed or perceived to be opposed to the third term of Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza.
Apollinaire Nyirora reporting. Learning by Air's Crime Fighter series is back, and this is what awaits you.
I can't believe anyone would stab Zawadi, of all people. She's the sweetest person I know, the best friend I've ever had.
There was this guy called Zake on Twari, you know, the social media website. This guy was always liking Zawadi's photos and commenting on them all the time.
So you think this man, Zake, stabbed Zawadi?
I know it's a long shot, but there has been an increase in cybercrime lately. And crimes related to social media use.
Oh my goodness! Are those pictures of Zawadi?
Crime fighters.
Don't miss that very first episode on cybercrime starting Monday next week here on Africa Link. To the Democratic Republic of Congo now, where opposition parties have urged parents not to send their children to school on opening day. They called for a strike asking parents to protest against their contribution to teachers' salaries. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, apart from school fees, parents also contribute to the salaries of teachers, and this has been ongoing for the last 25 years. And the government doesn't have any plans to change that rule. Patrice Chitera has more.
It is midday at Saint Raphael College, one of Kinshasa's prominent Catholic schools. Parents are in a monthly meeting to be briefed. on the progress of the performance of students. The bell rings. It is time to go back to class for afternoon lessons. The issue of parents supporting teachers' pay is among the parents' meeting day. Not so long ago, the opposition called on the parents to protest against continued support to the teachers by not sending their children to school as the new term opened. In Congo, parents are required to contribute toward teachers' salaries. Long-serving teachers like 63-year-old Adela Ngyangi, who has been teaching at a secondary school for the past 33 years, found the arrangement frustrating.
When I started teaching, there was no issue of parents supporting teachers' payment. A teacher was the happiest among the public servants. A teacher would not ask himself questions about his monthly expenses because all conditions were good. It was better to be a teacher than to seek to become an accountant. Even ministers and deputies, who are the most favored, used to give considerations to teachers.
Parent contribution to teachers' pay was initiated by the Catholic Church in 1991 after a year-long teachers' strike. The then government of Mobutu was unable to pay civil servants due to international sanctions. Attempts by the current government to improve teachers' pay have not changed much. Charles Lubanji, a parent with two children at St. Raphael, says the system is impoverishing parents.
As parents, we are not pleased. The state must take its burden. We should stop boosting teachers' pay because it weighs on our incomes, and paying teachers would cost $450 annually per child in a primary school. And a parent who is a civil servant will hardly have that amount to support the school fees of his children because civil servants are poorly paid.
The government maintains that it is not yet ready to scrap the initiative. Jovem Mukadi is the advisor of the International Corporation in the Education Ministry. He explains why.
We cannot cancel the parents' motivation pay to teachers. Our government is working on a scheme to put more than 300,000 teachers on the payroll. Between 2007 and 2015, we've paid 200,000 teachers. The education budget has increased from $5 million to $40 million annually, meaning that there are efforts being made to improve the teachers' situation.
As of now, primary and secondary school teachers earn an average of $80 per month. The parent contribution serves as a motivation to keep teachers on board. Like many Congolese, the teachers' union expects the elections to bring in a new president whom they hope will make things better.
Patrice Chitera reporting there from Kinshasa on parents' contribution to teachers' salary.
Your say.
It's time now to hear what you, the listener, has to say about the stories we've been reporting. Jane Nyingi and Ole Tangen Jr. are here with this week's Your Say.
Antonio Muzaneza, Loka Mushima Naibe, Sultani, Suleiman, Tropicana.
So we are starting off this week with the violence witnessed in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The government claims that over 30 people were killed, with several more injured. This is a topic that drew a lot of comments from our listeners.
Charles Mwanza commented that it is a democratic republic, yet like in many other developing and underdeveloped nations, the despotic leader wants to cling to power. What an insult to democracy.
Vio Ann also got in the conversation saying absolute power. However corruptly sweet it may be, why not let someone else also enjoy it instead of clinging on power? Now lives have been lost. Who gains out of it?
Stanisi Lauzi from Tanzania had some simple advice for President Joseph Kabila. Mr. President, respect the Constitution.
tuishi pamoja milele.
Another topic that can't be ignored this week are cries of Kenyan journalists who feel intimidated by both the state and the politicians.
That's right. In fact, just this month, Kenya has hosted several protests by journalists, with some claiming that reporters have even been killed for doing their jobs.
From Nairobi, Josie Jay says that sometimes journalists are to be blamed for poisoning their working environment with unethical and biased stories.
Well, Maria Mandy disagrees and said that she fully supports the protests. Journalists need to unite and have a leader who can fight for their rights. At the moment, I don't know if they have anyone to turn to when aggrieved.
Last but not least was the article on our page about the death of at least 29 migrants whose boat capsized near Egyptian coastline. Hundreds of migrants from Egypt, Syria, and several African countries were on board.
Dewey Bob responded to the article saying, "It is very tragic. However, these people took a calculated risk and lost. As long as people continue to tempt fate, such incidents will happen."
Andrew Sturman wraps up this week's USA with a comment, "You'll keep seeing situations like this until Europe says, if you come by boat, we'll send you back." That's all we had time for today. We appreciate all your comments. Please keep them coming.
Jane Yingi and Ole Tangen Jr., many thanks. And also thanks to all you, the listeners, who contributed to that particular segment. If you'd like to have your comments read here on Africa Link as well, then send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany, or you can also send us a text message to country code 49160957 59510.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.com/Africa Link. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations. Send us your feedback in a text message and sign up for our newsletter, dw.com/Africa Link.
And some news update now. A decision is expected on Friday to Saturday by Gabon's Constitutional Court on contested election results amid a post-election crisis. President Ali Bongo was declared the winner of the August 27 elections. And before we leave you, a quick recap of the main stories. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has invited the United Nations to negotiate with Boko Haram on the release of the kidnapped schoolgirls. Migration experts met in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, to discuss the migration crisis in the Horn of Africa. And opposition parties in the Democratic Republic of Congo are urging parents to strike against contribution to teachers' salaries. That's all we had time for. For more stories, visit our webpage, dw.com/Africa. And as always, thank you for listening. My colleague Jane Ayeko Kumet will be here with you on Monday. Please join her if you can. Until next time, this is Abubakar Jallow in Bonn. Have a pleasant weekend. We'll be right back.